Who are they? Said Richard. They're just stones. They came off an island down the river before it was flooded. Richard shook his head. Listen, don't say who. It must say something. He read the stone again. He shook his head. It's war, he said. Near naked. His face wrinkled. What is it? Danged old chewing gum. Let's try another one. We ought not to be doing this, drinking off folks' gravestones. Why not? I don't know. Would you care? If it was some of my kin, I would. What if it was you? I ain't dead. If you were dead, and me and Callahan drank off it, your stone. I don't know. I'd be dead. I'd drink off Billy Ray's. I would, too, said Suttree. I'd drink off of it in a minute. Suttree grinned. Course, maybe if you was dead, you'd think different. I mean, if you're dead and all, well, I expect you got to be pretty religious. We'd drink you a toast. Have a good time. Richard smiled wanly. Well, he said, I'd like a good time well as the next feller. I'll get us another beer. But Richard was fumbling in his pockets, and he stopped Suttree with his hand. Let me get 'em, bud, he said. What do they get for a beer down here? 35. Richard frowned. He's high, ain't he? I reckon it's on account of the gambling. He doesn't have a license. For gambling? For anything. For living. I never see him uptown. He don't say hidey, said Richard. They don't make him no whiter. He doled the change into Suttree's palm, and Suttree went to the box and got two more beers and came back to a new table. He took the blind man by the hand and led him to it. Doll raised her one eye from where she slept in her shapeless chair, her heavy arms folded across her bosom. One of the poker players jacked his chair back and reached for the stove door and opened it, and looked in, and she rose heavily and made her way across the floor to the coal scuttle. When she came back from tending the stove, she wiped the tables that they'd read and eyed them curiously. Richard had his eyes closed, and the smoke from his cigarette rose alongside his thin nose. Something had passed out on the river, and the shanty lifted and settled in the swells. Richard suddenly placed his hands flat on the table. Then he lifted them off again, as if it were hot. He took up his beer in both hands and held it like that. I ain't reading no more, he said. What is it? Said Suttree. The blind man sucked on his cigarette and shook his head. The thin gray webs of flesh in his neck trembled. What is it? Said Suttree. There was an oil lamp sconced in the wall above the table, and the blind man beneath it sat clearly lit. Suttree looked at his dead eyes, but there was no way of seeing in. What is it? He said again. You knowed what it was, didn't you? No, I don't know. You ain't done it for meanness? I swear I don't know what it says. He was running his own hand under the table, but he could not read the stone. Will you keep it to yourself? Said Richard. Yes. What does it say? Between you and me? Yes. It says, William Callahan. He woke early with the cold and sat in his cot cross-legged, swaddled up in his blanket and looking out the small window. The sun kindled the haze into a salmon-colored drop against which the brittle trees stood like burnt lace. Charred-looking sparrows japed and chittered on the rail. Suttree parted back the sackcloth curtains to better see downriver, and the birds flew. He was still sitting there when someone came aboard and knocked at his door. He leaned and reached his shirt up from the floor. The knocking came again. Someone called his name softly, as if he ailed. When he went to the door, Reese was standing there. He carried a new cap in his hands and smiled thinly. Come in, said Suttree.
I ain't got but a minute. I come to give you your shares.
Come in. He stood in the little room, holding his cap, 1 foot wide, to shore himself against the tilted floor. Suttree sought his shoes under the bed and stepped into them sockless, and turned and sat on the couch. "Sit down, Reese," he said. "Sit down." Reese sat at the little table and took his pocketbook from the bib of his overalls and opened it. He lifted out a sheaf of bills, tied with a dirty string, and laid them on the table, and folded the pocketbook and put it away again. "What's that?" said Sutry.
"That's your shares. We never got sold till last week. We had an awful lot of trouble."
"I don't want it," said Sutry. "Put it back in your pocket." Reese set his lips and shook his head.
"It's yourn," he said.
"Well, let me give it to you."
"No."
Sutry looked at the money and shook his head.
"Where are you living now?" he said. "We're back up in Jefferson County. Willard run off."
"How are you?"
"I'm okay. I never did understand that boy. I never would just get to where I could talk to him but what he'd up and do some hatefulness, and it not a bit of use in the world in it."
Sutry ran his hand through his hair. The old man seemed small and older yet, sitting there.
"I never did blame you for leaving out. Poor luck as we had, I reckon you'd have done better never to have took up with us to start. Did you ever know anybody to be so bad about luck?"
Sutry said he had. He said that things would get better. The old man shook his head doubtfully, paying the band of his cap through his fingers.
"I'm satisfied they can't get no worse," he said.
"But there are no absolutes in human misery, and things can always get worse." Only Sutry didn't say so. In the afternoon, he went uptown. He bought a thick army sweater at Bowers, and he paid Stud $20 on his lunch tab, and he went to Regis and ate a steak dinner. When he got home, he still had $40 left. As he let himself in at his door, he thought he heard his name called somewhere like those sourceless voices that address our dreams. He went in and shut the door and lit the lamp and sat on the cot. As he was taking off his shoes, he heard it again, thin and far, somewhere in the night. He sat with a shoe in one hand, listening. He put his shoe back on and went out. Blind Richard was hailing him from the bridge.
"What is it?"
the fisherman called. The blind man on the bridge raised his thin arm into the lamplight like a supplicant to the chalice of God's bright mercies. A ghost of a voice fell. Sutry couldn't hear what it said, but he cupped his hand to his mouth.
"No,"
he called. His name drifted down from the steel span hung in the night.
"Go home, Richard. It's late."
The blind man called again, but he could not find his way down to the river, and Sutry turned his back on him and his cries and went in and shut the door. Billy Ray Callahan labored for a while as a tile setter, but was fired for drinking. The crew chief stopped him coming from his lunch break and confronted him.
"You can't drink on the job and put in a day's work. You want a drink? You can get your time now."
The crew chief's name was Hicks. Callahan grinned at him.
"Why, Hicks," he said, "if I was you, I wouldn't be caught without a drink of whiskey on my breath."
Hicks looked suspicious.
"What do you mean?" he said. "Why, so people would think I was drunk instead of just so damned ignorant."
He went to Atlanta looking for work, but he didn't find any. He fought two boys from Steubenville, Ohio, in the alley behind the bus station, and left one senseless in the well of a cellar window, and went into the men's room and washed his swollen fist with cold water, and crossed the station to the gate and boarded the bus back to Knoxville, where he worked what jobs he could find, tracking by night his isobar of violence through the streets and taverns. Sutry saw him whip a boy from Vestal named George Holmes, a tall boy who used to like to shoot people. All along the wall by the B&J, folks from McAnally and Vestal stood dangerously together, and Sutry saw pistols gripped in pockets and out. Callahan hit Holmes twice, and Holmes went down. He'd have let it go at that, but the crowd called out for more.
"Stomp him, Red! Stomp his ass!"
He gave Holmes a few kicks, but Holmes only doubled himself up on the sidewalk. When the police cruiser rounded the corner and came up the hill, Callahan took off up Commerce and lay in the parking lot under Junior Long's car. The cruiser went back down the hill, with Holmes in the back of it, crying and cursing, and the crowd had already begun to move away. Holmes had shot a dentist in Vestal not long before this, and not long after he shot and killed a man across a card table at Ab Franklin's and was sent to the penitentiary. Years later, he got out and went back to Franklin's and was shot dead himself over the same table. The last job Callahan had was running a bootleg joint for a man named Cotton down off Ayler Avenue. Sutry saw him in Comer's, and he looked subdued.
"I seen you the other day, and you didn't know me," he said.
"Bullshit," said Sutry. "I never saw you. Where at?" Callahan put his arm around Sutry's shoulder and patted him on the belly.
"These old summer rabbits," he said. "You can set on 'em, and they won't hardly even squeal."
At the woodshed in McAnally, they bought whiskey and rolled lightless out the far end of the alley, passing the bottle about in the brown paper bag. They drove up Gay Street, where Comer's was closing, and the hustlers stood about the stairwell, Callahan leaning from the window of the car to hoot at them, and they drove past the little cafes and restaurants where dishwashers were cleaning up in the dim backlight, and they passed folks coming from the last movie who seemed almost unhinged by what they'd seen or were seeing. At the West End, Callahan routed an outland troop from the premises.
"And ain't they got no beer joints where you come from? And don't let the door hit you in the ass going out."
Sutry in the washroom stood slightly drunk and read the legends on the weeping wall. Advised that he was pissing on his shoes. Untrue. Wanted to trade 2 blind crabs for 1 with no teeth. He looked up at the clotted bulb overhead. He buttoned and pushed open the plywood door and went out. It ended on the Clinton Highway at the Moonlight Diner. Billy Ray smiling and going among the tables while the band played country music. He had his hands in his pockets when the barman confronted him. Small, vicious, quiet. He said,
"Red, you've been stealing money out of them girls' purses."
Callahan rocked back on his heels with his hooligan smile and looked down at his assassin. His pockets were full of the stolen change spoken. He'd drunk their drinks.
"You're a damned liar," he said, good-naturedly.
In the act is wedded the interior man, and the man is seen. When he was shot, he had his hands in his pockets. The last word came out, "lie." The roar of the pistol in his face chopped it off, and the size of the silence that followed was enormous. Billy Ray was standing there with a small discolored hole alongside his ruined nose. A trickle of thin blood started down his face. The band had finished their set, and the people going to the tables paused and looked toward the bar, where a small cloud of pale smoke hovered above Billy Ray's shaggy head. They saw him lurch and topple. Curious, the small and lesser fates that joined to lead a man to this. The 1,000 brawls and stoven jaws, the clubbings and the broken bottles and the little knives that come from nowhere. For him, perhaps, it all was done in silence. Or how would it sound, the shot that fired the bullet that lay already in his brain? These small enigmas of time and space and death. He was lying on his back with one leg doubled under him. He was bleeding from the ears and from the nose and from the hole in his face, and he was breathing deeply and regular, and he was looking up at the ceiling. The murderer had put the gun back in his pocket and stood looking on like any other spectator. A number of people had already started for the door, and when Sutry came up, Gary was squatting down looking at Billy Ray as if he did not know what to make of his lying there like that.
"Oh, my God," said Sutry.
Callahan's eyes closed slowly. His whole face was blue, and he closed his eyes so that you could not see death come up in them like a face at a window. Sutry pushed through the people and ran for the telephone at the back wall. They pulled a blanket over him, but Sutry drew it back from his face.
"Cover him up," said the ambulance attendant.
"He's not dead."
They gave Sutry a look much like a shrug and lifted the gurney into the rear of the ambulance, and Sutry climbed in and sat on the little banquette at the side, and the door closed after him. Shrieking through the streets of Knoxville, the red dome light sweeping the near walls in narrow places, the windows, faces in cars. Billy Ray turned his head once and arched his neck. The pad beneath him grew black with blood. All through the town tonight, our folks lie dying. Sirens in the city like the shriek of jackal birds. They wheeled him through the emergency room door and into a small white room. There was a steel lamp in the ceiling and a steel table beneath it, and there were steel cabinets along one wall. The orderlies lifted Callahan onto the table and wheeled the gurney out again. A nurse looked at him lying there, his chest rising and falling. Someone had put a patch of gauze over the hole in his head, and the blood around his ears had blackened and dried. A great, rug-headed lout lying there with his heavy hands composed alongside him. She shook her head and closed the door. Later, an orderly came in and looked at him and went out again. He returned with a doctor. The doctor carried a clipboard under his arm, and he entered the room and pulled the gauze away from Callahan's face and looked at the hole. He lifted the eyelids and looked in, and he lifted the shaggy head and let it back again. The orderly was watching the doctor. The doctor pursed his lips and made a little casual gesture with one hand. He felt Billy Ray's pulse and looked at his watch and raised his eyebrows. He said something to the orderly and then went out again, the orderly behind him, the orderly closing the door. Sutry and Callahan's older brother Charlie rose from their chairs. "There's nothing we can do for that man," said the doctor.
"He's not dead," said Sutry.
"No," said the doctor, "he's not dead." The last visitor was an old black orderly, a gentleman who washed the stricken and the dead. He pulled back the gauze and unscrewed the top from a bottle of alcohol and poured it slowly down the hole into Billy Ray's brain. He lived for another 5 hours and died sometime before daybreak unattended. They hadn't even taken off his shoes. Charlie had gone home, and Sutry and the mother sat in the little waiting room. When the doctor came out and told them he was dead, Billy Ray's mother began to cry very quietly. She sat there with her chin quivering, and she shook her head slowly from side to side over her dead warrior. Sutry touched her shoulder, but she waved him away, and she did not look up. He walked out of the hospital and across the wet grass toward the road. Very slowly, the lights of the city were going out, the billboards, the street lamps. He crossed the river by the high iron bridge, past the orchards in the dark, lights in the water upstream and the sky paling, and the night and its disciplines draining away, leaving the barren trees as black as iron and a paper city rising in the dawn. A great stillness had fallen. He walked through the dead gray streets. A news peddler was opening his bale of papers at the corner. The street sweepers had passed, and in the black gutter water the lights from the pole lamps lay like pie tins among the darker neon bleedings. He leaned against the viaduct rail, spat numbly at the tracks down there, at the dreams implicit in their endless steel reachings. Section hands were slouching toward work in the switching yard. The Watkins man pushed his little trundle cart of nostrums across the bridge, humped between the cart tongues in the wan daybreak. Sutry went down the narrow back path at the end of the bridge. He passed beneath the house of the madman, but he was not about at such an hour. Sutry stooped and scrabbled up a half a brickbat and slammed it off the curling clapboards high under the eaves. A crazed putty face slobbered up against the glass, a wild eye cocked there. Sutry turned and went on down the path toward the river. He spent his days in the poorer quarters of the town, seeking out some place with steam heat where he could winter cheaply. The season had grown cold and sunless, and a mean wind was in the streets. He found at last a room in the deeps of McAnally. A gray-looking woman regarded him sourly through the screen door. "I came to see about the room," he said. She sorted a key from among clotted tissues in her apron pocket and unlatched the screen door and handed it out. "It's around the back," she said. "How much is it?" $5 a week. He thanked her and went around the house by a brick walkway, past old gray bushes clogged with leaves and down steps into an unpaved alley. The door was open, and he walked in and stood in a dim and musty cellar. A furnace with upflung ductwork like a fat and rusty Medusa, a dead iron grin in the door grate. He crossed to a painted blue door and peered in. A small cubicle with a concrete floor
an iron cot. He looked back into the furnace room. Some stairs materialized out of the deeper gloom, and he crossed to them and mounted upward to a door at the top. Long nailed to. A dead light bulb hung from a fly-specked cord. He turned in the dark of the landing and came back. The frayed and rotting stair carpet wore blooms of pale blue mold. In a corner of the cellar was a zinc laundry tub. He tried the taps. A brown liquid spat into the sink and lay there. He went back into the room. There were two small windows let into wells high along one wall, the glass covered with rain-spattered sand and hung with spider webs. Sutri looked out at the brambly undercarriage of a hedge, some white-stalked grass, perhaps wild onions. In the wells, dry leaves and papers, a weathered wooden fire truck. He sat on the cot and looked around, but there wasn't much to look at, and after a while he went back out and around the house to the front door again. She stood veiled behind the screen, holding out her hand for the key. "I'll take it," he said.
"Is it just yourself?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"That'll be $5.
He had his money out, crossing the serried palm with wilted green. "Is that everything there is? I mean, you don't have an extra rug or something, do you?"
"I'll see if I do."
She folded the bill into her apron pocket and faded away down the lightless hall. He brought his blankets over and things for coffee. He lay in the little room in the dark a long time, listening to the noises, and he woke all night to the passing of cars in the street. In the gray dawn, he felt alien and not unhappy and lay staring up at the pipes in their hangers on the ceiling, wrapped in burlap or canvas and leaking kapok or a white plaster-like substance. What woke him was a clanging of iron from the outer chamber, and when he went to the door and looked out, there was a small black hunchback with enormous orange teeth gleaming in the firelight at the furnace door. "Hey," said Sutri. When the black saw him, he turned and began to bow and smile and shuffle and make mouths until Sutri thought he dealt here with a wandered idiot. "Are you the furnace man?"
Yes,
said the black, removing his coachman's hat with the lacquered black wickerwork vents. "Shit," said Sutri.
Yes.
"What time is it? What's your name?" The furnace man was winching up a watch enormous from the pocket of his trousers.
10:00, Nelson,"
he said, holding the face of the watch towards Sutri, should there be any question. "Okay, Nelson, thanks."
Yes,
said Nelson. Sutri pushed the door shut. He held his hand to the ventilator overhead. A faint breath there. He lit his little kerosene stove and took his kettle out to the sink. Nelson was loading scoops of coal through the iron door into the furnace, where a sulphurous smoke swirled. He turned and offered up his ape's grimace, all teeth and eyes wedged shut, and Sutri nodded at him and turned the tap. The water coughed and spattered clots of iron scale into the sink and finally cleared to a silty dun color, not unlike the river's, and Sutri filled his kettle and clopped in sockless shoes back across the gritty concrete floor to his room again. The only piece of furniture, other than the cot, was a small table with thread spool pulls to the one drawer. It was painted blue, and in the drawer lay last year's Sunday News, already foxed and yellow. A few silverfish scuttled away. Sutri had set his little burner on the table, and he sat on the bed and read the lacy scrap of newsprint while the water boiled. It was dark enough to want a light of some kind, but there was no bulb in the ceiling. He heard the fireman clank shut the door and leave, and he poured the coffee and stirred in milk from a can, and sipped in blue and red of wildness and violence across the cup's rim. As it was then, is now, and ever shall. He was dressed and out by 11:00, feeling very much a resident of the city, which made him smile to himself, as might Harrogate, on whom his thoughts ran this brisk November morn. He carried off scouring powder and soap and brushes from the men's rooms of restaurants, a broom and a mop from a back porch. Get the bucket, too. He swept and scrubbed, and in the afternoon went into town and bought cheap muslin for curtains and a wall lamp from the dime store. That evening he carried up everything from the shanty toting his boxes aboard the Euclid Avenue bus and kicking them into the empty space behind the driver's seat while he rummaged his pockets for a dime, and went to figure among the figures through the chill and broken lamplight over the old streets, down Ayler Avenue to the Live and Let Live grocery, where he bought eggs and sausage and bread for a late-night breakfast. Anybody seeing him all that forewinter long, going about the sadder verges of the city, might have rightly wondered what his trade was, this refugee, reprieved from the river and its fishes, haunting the streets in a cast-off peacoat, among old men in cubbyhole lunchrooms where life's vagaries were discussed, where things would never be as they had been. In Market Street, the flowers were gone and the bells chimed cold and lonely, and the old vendors nodded and agreed that joy seemed gone from these days, none knew where. In their faces, signature of the soul's remoteness, Sutri felt their looming doom, the humming in the wires, no news is good. Old friends in the street that he met, some just from jail, some taken to trades. Earl Solomon studying to be a steam fitter, so he said. They looked through his books and manuals there in the cold wind, and Earl seems uncertain, smiling sadly at it all. He'd sit on the front bench at Comer's and watch through the window the commerce in the street below, the couples moving toward the box office of the theater in the rainy evening, the lights of the marquee slurred and burning in the wet street. There was a letter for him, the stamp canceled by a vicious slash of dried bird lime. He read a few lines backward candled against the light at the window, and wadded it, and put it in the trash. One day, coming up market, he caught sight of a crowd, among which the maddest man of God yet seen had appeared electrically out of the carbonic fog. He was some two-thirds of a man tall, and heavily set, and red all over, this preacher. He had red curly hair on the back of his balding and boiled-looking head, and his skin was pale red and splotched with huge blood-colored freckles, and he was delivering the word in such fashion as even the oldest codgers on this street, long jaded to the crop with crazed gospelarity, could scarcely credit. Hucksters left their carts and vans untended. The pencil vendor, crouched in his corner, came crawling and growling through the crowd. The Red Reverend had hardly begun. He tore out of his coat and rolled his sleeves. "This ain't going to get it," he said. "No." He made a sweeping gesture down market and toward the market house. "No, this just ain't going to get it. Friends, this ain't where it's at." The water truck had passed on Union, and a creek came curling down the gutter, black and choked with refuse. The preacher scooped a bobbing turnip from the flood and held it aloft. "He provideth," he said. He knelt, oblivious to all, offering up the turnip, the water boiling about his thighs and sucking down the storm sewer. He washed the turnip like a raccoon and took a great bite. "Here's where it's at," he said, spewing chewed turnip. "On your knees, in the streets, that's where it's at."
An old man, mad as he, knelt beside. The preacher passed him the turnip.
"He give out the loaves and the fishes," he howled. "Therefore asked not, what shall I put on?"
The turnip was going from hand to hand in search of communicants. The old man had crawled into the flooded gutter among the sewage and was demanding baptism. But the preacher had risen with his red hands joined in a demented madras above his glowing skull and begun a dance of exorcism.
"In the marketplace," he screamed. "But not this buying and selling."
He had begun to rotate with arms outspread and his small feet mincing like a revolving parody of the crucifixion. His eyes had swiveled back in his head and his lips worked feverishly. He went faster. The old man had arisen dripping, and he tried to emulate this new and Rufus prophet, but he tilted and fell, and the preacher had begun to rotate with such speed that the crowd dropped back, and some just stayed their hands from clapping. Sutri went on. A mute and shapeless derelict would stop him with a puffy hand run forth from the cavernous sleeve of an army coat. Woe scrivened, a paling heart that holds a name half gone in grime. Sutri looked into the ruined eyes, where they burned in their tunnels of disaster. The lower face hung in sagging wattles like a great scrotum. Some mumbled word of beggary, to make your heart more desolate. In the evening, he would cross Vine Avenue Hill on his way homeward,
past the old school he'd attended in his infancy, morgue-like with its archives of bitterness, past the church with her pawn-shop globes of milk glass lightly decked, each with a doily of coal soot, and past old brick apartments where in upper window corners a white hand might wipe the glass, and glazed in the sash a painted face appear, some wizened whore-clown. Will you come up? Do you dare? He never. Maybe once. Crossing the Western Avenue viaduct, he'd stop and lean upon the concrete balustrade, where polished river stones lay in the cracks, and gaze down at the broad sprawl of tracks in the yard, and the tarred roofs of rail cars, a lonely figure framed against the gray pales of the city's edges, with the smokestacks reared against the squalid winter sky like Gothic organ pipes, and black and tuneless flags of soot stood down the wind. One night he came upon a house aflame, and took a seat beyond harm's way to watch, people coming to the front door like ants out of a burning log, carrying their effects. One struggled with an old man in a nightcap who seemed bent upon incineration, tottering about and mouthing gummed curses backward at the fates so long familiar. Lights appeared up and down the street. Neighbors in their flannel robes came out to watch. An upper window sagged and buckled and collapsed. Sheets of flame ran up the clapboards, and they blistered and curled in the heat. A hot blue light crackled through the orange smoke.
How'd it start?
Sutry looked down. A little man was leaning to him with the question. I don't know, said Sutry. How all things start. He rose and went on. A police cruiser must ask his name. Where is he going? Sutry, proper and well-spoke, bridling the malice in his heart. Pass on. Down alleyways where cats couple, rows of ash cans and dark low doors. This pane of dusty light. Sutry stood in a kitchen among fugitives and mistried felons. A stout woman doled beers from a cooler and made change out of an apron pocket in which hung the shape of a small automatic pistol. An emaciated whore eyed him as he entered, a stringy, slow-eyed cunt with false teeth and a razorous pelvis beneath the thin dress she wore. Wallace Humphrey stood in one corner with his eyes half closed and his hands dangling. In his old-fashioned suit, he looked like one of those Western bad men photographed hanging from barn doors or propped up in shop windows shot full of holes. Let me have a red top, Sutry said. She handed him a bottle and held out her wet red hand. Sutry placed a half dollar in it and got his change and went past the whore toward the living room. Hey, sweetie, she said. Hey, said Sutry. Through the smoke, he saw friends among the drinkers and he made his way toward them.
Here's old Sutry, called Hoghead. Welcome to the Buffalo Room, said Bucket. Where's old J-Bone, Sut?
He's still up in Cleveland.
When's he coming back?
I don't know. I had a letter from him, said he was working as an assembler. He said every morning he assembles his ass in a corner and watches the proceedings for 8 hours.
Old Richard Harper is back from Chicago, him and Junior. Harper was supposed to get him staked up there, and Junior said he'd like to got him burned at the stake. Junior said the Windy City wasn't ready for Harper. He said they had enough wind as it was. Get you a drink here, Sut.
Bucket pulled a pint bottle from behind him and handed it to Sutry, and he unscrewed the cap and drank.
Bobby John's old crazy uncle was in here a while ago, Bud. He was going on about hauling whiskey back in the Prohibition. Said they come into Knoxville early one morning with a load. Wasn't daylight yet. Old Tip said he was asleep in the front seat, and there was a car backfired, and he raised up and shot a woman waiting on the bus. Said he seen her feet sticking out of a hedge.
Sutry grinned and drank from his beer. Figures slouched through the smoke like ghosts, and there was about the room that eerie reverence felt in places where great crimes have been done. He stayed till the last cup was drained, leaning in a doorway in the small hours, watching a fat whore humping on a bed that bore the black shoe tracks of many a traveler. Drifting with the last customers down the alley toward the street, giggles and catcalls, the plastic purses of the whores cutting garish curves in the milk-blue light of the street lamps, plates of white ice broken in the chuck holes, a small coal-colored owl trilled from a light pole, and Sutri looked and saw him fluff against the sky. He called again, called softly. Sutri sat on an old stone curb with his back to the pole, a silent dweller in a singing wood. Newsboys were putting forth with wagons through the murk, old feral fathers waiting in the surf of older dawns to launch their tarred boats on some dark and ropey shoal. An empty beer can rolled in a light tin clank down the street before the dawn wind. Wind cold in his nostrils. He watched the graying in the east, a soiled aurora, the city's fabled salience rising through the mist. Sunday morning, Sutri shuffled down a dim stairwell in the clothes in which he'd slept. Across the street, the market house stood gaunt and dark in the easy rain. Hunched in front of the hotel, in an uncanny silence, he sucked his coated teeth. Old awnings covered the barren truck beds and barrows. You could hear the small heel taps of an idle whore receding in the streets. Claustral landscape of building faces, even to the sky. The heel clicks sing with a stinging sound. Sutri looked upward, the Baroque hotel front flaking a pea-green paint. A church clock tolling. Pigeons reel and flap in the bell peal. In the gutted rooms, sad quaking sots are waking to the problem of the Sunday morning drink. It seemed to rain all that winter. The few snowfalls turned soon to a gray slush, but the brief white quietude among the Christmas buntings and soft-lit shop windows seemed a childhood dream of the season, and the snow, when its soft falling sifting down, evoked in the city a surcease nigh to silence. Silent the few strays that entered the huddle, dusting their shoulders and brushing from their hair this winter night's benediction. Sutri, by the window, watched through the frosted glass. How the snow fell cherry red in the soft neon flush of the beer sign, like the slow dropping of blood. The clerks and the curious are absent tonight. Blind Richard sits with his wife, the junk man drunk, his mouth working mutely and his neck awry like a hanged man's. A young homosexual alone in the corner crying. Sutri, among others, sad children of the fates whose home is the world, all gathered here a little while to forestall the going there. He spent a lot of time in the library reading magazines. An assortment of wild-eyed freaks used to frequent the upstairs reading room, glancing furtively about, their cocks hanging out of their trousers beneath the tables, eyeing the schoolboys. One evening, coming out of May's Cafe and heading toward the B&J, he passed two women sailing along in the other direction. He turned around and followed them back in. They spoke with Yankee accents, a jivey kind of talk he thought he'd listened to, and he took the booth behind them and ordered a beer. Before he'd taken a sip of it, one of them turned and fixed him with an up-and-down look of brazen appraisal. "What's happening in this town?" she said. Sutri hung his arm over the back of the booth and looked at them. "Not much," he said. "Where are you all from?"
"Chicago."
"How long you been here?"
"Off and on for a couple of months."
"Off and on is right, sweetie,"
said the older one. The other one smiled at Sutri.
"We're hustlers," she said, "but we won't hustle you."
Sutri liked her. "Well," he said, "there's usually something going on at the Indian Rock.
You want to go out there with us?"
He rubbed his jaw. The clock hanging from the ceiling turned on its gilt chain. 11:20.
"I'm Joyce, and this is Margie,"
the nice one said.
"Hi, Joyce. Hi, Margie."
"What do you think?"
"Okay," he said. "I guess so."
They went in a cab, the three of them in the back and him in the middle. They were all a little drunk. She pulled out a handful of money to pay the cab with, but he pushed it back and paid himself. The cab driver hissed at him to bend and hear.
"Them old gals is hustlers."
Sutri patted him on the arm.
When he danced with her, she pressed her thigh between his legs and breathed against his neck. Hard impress of her pubic bone. She smelled very good. The older one kept cutting in on them, and Sutri would have to dance with her. He saw no one he knew except Roop the drummer, who kept winking huge hobgoblin winks at him.
"You never told me your name," she said.
"Bud."
"Bud."
"Yeah."
"Okay, Bud."
They'd been drinking whiskey, and he found the floor a bit unmanageable, but she didn't seem to notice. She nibbled his jugular with crimped lips.
"I like you, Bud," she said.
"How do you know?"
I can tell.
Can you feel it in the marrow of your bones?
That's not exactly the spot.
How long are you going to be around?
I don't know. A while. I can't go back to Chicago.
Why not?
A little indictment.
Ah.
I travel around. I'm in and out of Knoxville.
In and out and off and on. She bit his neck. Do you want another drink?
I'd love one. Let me get them.
I've got them. He walked her back to the table and called the waitress.
That girl that was here said to tell you she had to go,
the waitress said. They looked at each other. Sutry ordered ice and drinks, and the waitress moved away, writing on her pad, her lips moving.
You didn't say anything to her, did you? Said Sutry.
No. You know I didn't.
They watched each other over the rims of their half-empty glasses. They started giggling. When they pulled up in the mouth of the alley, she put her hand on his leg, apprehensive as a young girl. It's all right, he said.
What's here?
I live here.
There's no lights.
It's all right.
Why don't we go to my hotel?
Sutry was already out. He had one hand extended to help her out, and the other lay on the cold steel top of the taxi. He looked up at the dim and midnight shadow world of shapes above McAnally, dark nightscape of light wires and chimney pots. He reached down and took her hand. Look, he said, I'm not Jack the Ripper. I live just down here. It's not much, but it's clean, and I've got something to drink. A couple of beers, I know, and a little in the bottom of a bottle of whiskey, I think. Come on. She emerged cautiously from the cab, and Sutry held her hand while he paid the driver. He slammed the door shut, and the cab pulled away, and he took her down the little cinder path alleyway, taking his key from his pocket, showing her the way. He opened the door and turned on the light. She stood in a cellar. Fire showed in the slotted mouth of the furnace, and a wild melee of piping reeled away over the ceiling, their own shadows dipping in the slight swing of the light bulb from its cord. A deep, musty smell. She turned and looked at him.
I must be crazy, she said. Will someone tell me what I'm doing here?
He crossed to the door of his room.
What's that, the coal bin?
He turned the light on in his cubicle and ushered her in. She leaned in the doorway with one hand on his shoulder.
Well,
she said. Go ahead. He closed the door. They sat on the bed and kissed. They fumbled with each other.
Hmm,
she said. She leaned and licked his ear and whispered in.
What you don't do right, she said, you're going to have to do over.
Winter sunlight, parried from an upper wall, fell over them from the high window. He lay awake in the narrow cot, one hand dangling on the floor. He turned to look at her. Pull back these covers from her chin. Is she gross? Is she horrid? Is she old? She lay slack-mouthed in sleep, and not unlovely. He laid his face against her full breasts and slept again. When he woke, she was sitting on the edge of the bed in one of his shirts, smiling down at him, her ash-blonde hair tumbled about her face. She was holding a cup of coffee for him. Hi, he said.
Hello, lover. Are you ready for liquids? Yes, I know. Just sit up a bit.
She fluffed the pillow with one hand and then held the cup to his lips.
What time is it?
Noon.
Do you have to go?
Yes.
She brushed back his hair. He drank the coffee.
I copped one of your shirts, she said.
You won't leave those bumps in it, will you?
No,
she said, taking the cup. She leaned over him.
I won't leave anything messed up or marked on except you.
She kissed him. She tasted of mint. She ran her hand down his belly.
Oh, my, she said.
What do you want? Said Sutry, grinning.
When he woke again, she was dressed and sitting at the table combing her hair. He watched her. She put the comb in her purse and snapped it shut and turned around and came over to the bed.
I've got to go, baby.
Well,
is that laundry tub what you bathe in?
Yes, such as it is.
I was stripped off out there washing my pussy when some spade came in. An old guy. He almost fainted.
Marvelous, said Sutry. What did he say?
Well, he had on this crazy hat, and he took it off and began to bow and to back out the door saying, "Excuse me, ma'am, excuse me, ma'am."
God help him. He'll be more peculiar than ever. She brushed his hair back.
When will I see you?
I don't know.
What are you doing tonight?
Nothing. Are you asking for a date?
Do you mind?
No.
May I see you this evening?
It'll have to be someplace cheap.
I've got some money. Baby, don't. I've really got to go. Baby.
She left in mid-afternoon. He lay in the bed, a depleted potentate. He felt very good. A wan midwinter sun hung low and oblong under the lured fish-shaped clouds. A sun hot-jowled and squat in the seeping lavender dusk. Down this narrow street where the Chinese sign glows green. She is waiting, cupboarded in one of the high booths. A congenial Oriental to bid good evening. Sutry saw her smile from a far corner. No, with the young lady there. The waitress smiled.
Hello, baby.
Hello. He slid into the seat opposite, but she took his hand.
Come sit by me.
He stood up again. Come over here, he said, so we don't bump elbows.
You're a southpaw.
Yes. She rubbed past him.
Nice, she said.
She was wearing a pale yellow knit dress that fit her all over, and she looked very good. They sat and looked at each other, and she leaned and kissed him. How long have you been here? He said.
I don't know. Half hour?
I didn't know I was so late.
I don't care. I don't mind waiting for you as long as you come.
Did you get wet?
No, I got a cab.
Is it still raining out? No. What shall we eat?
You want me to make a suggestion?
She was smiling at him, and she had taken his elbow in both hands. No, he said. They sat together in the booth, looking over the newspaper-sized menu. The butterfly shrimp are good.
Why don't you order for us?
Okay. What about the combination platter?
That sounds good. Does it have the sweet and sour pork?
Yes, and let's get some egg rolls.
With hot mustard.
You like hot mustard?
Yes, do you?
I love it. They have some here that will completely remove your sinuses.
I'm hip.
There was no one else in the restaurant. It grew dark outside the window, and she held his arm, and they sipped tea and waited for the food to come. They went to a movie. He smiled at the memories induced, sitting rigid and frightened alongside some girl child trying to muster the courage to take her hand. The two of them whispering sexual slanders concerning the actors into each other's ear, vying to elaborate the most outrageous perversions. They had coffee at the Farragut coffee shop, and they walked through the streets in the small rain and muted lights and looked in the shop windows, wrapped in their coats and huddled close, and the smell of her good perfume and her hair. And she, who had not stopped smiling like a happy cat the evening long, took him by the arm down Gay Street to her hotel, and through the steamed glass doors into the lobby, the old white tiles and potted plants and polished brasswork. She sauntered to the desk and got her key and came back and took him by the arm, and they went to the elevator with a small tan-colored bellhop who had been reading the paper at a table in the lobby. The old brass lattice door clicked shut, and they began to rise. A dim hum of mechanisms, cables that slithered in a steep brick well.
"You getting any of this white pussy, James?"
she said. James shook his head that he wasn't. She held Sutry's arm. They got off at the fifth floor and went down a long corridor, a black rubber rug, past door and door alike with metal numbers nailed on them, or missing, or askew. She put the key in her door and opened it and held out her hand for him to enter. "Go ahead," he said. He followed her in, and she shut the door and took off her coat and hung it on the back of the door and turned to him and began to unbutton his peacoat. The room was neat and orderly, with a great sprawl of cosmetics across the dressing table and bureau top, and a portable hairdryer and curlers and some expensive-looking clothes hung from the walls. A great stuffed ape with long arms and orange hair sat on the bed.
"That's Og," she said.
"Who named him that, you?"
"My girlfriend. She gave him to me."
"Margie?"
"No. Chicken Chicago. Christ, this thing weighs a ton."
"Let me get it."
"I've got it. You're not wet, are you? Your head's wet."
"It's all right." She had a towel and was tousling his hair with it.
"You look like a little boy," she said. "Here, sit down. Let me see if there's any music on the radio."
Sutri unzipped his shoes and kicked them off and scooted back on the bed and crossed his feet and lifted one of the ape's arms and let it fall again.
"You like hillbilly?"
"Anything."
"I used to hate it."
"Find something else." There was a knock on the door, and she went to answer it. The elevator man stood with a tin bucket of ice and a pint of whiskey in a paper bag.
"Baby," she said, "do you want a Coke or something? I didn't think to ask you."
"I don't need anything." She paid the stolid yellow James and shoved the change back at him and shut the door with her elbow. She set the bucket and the package of whiskey on the bedside table and took a pair of glass tumblers from the shelf above the sink and brought them over and filled them with ice. She sat on the edge of the bed and started peeling at the seal on the bottle until Sutri took it from her and twisted the cap loose with his teeth. He poured the drinks, and they sat on the bed opposite each other and sipped and looked at each other and smiled.
"I wonder if I'm already hungry again or if it's something else," she said.
"They say that's the trouble with Chinese girls."
"What?"
"An hour later and you're horny again." She smiled and sipped from her glass. There was altogether too much of her sitting there, the broad expanse of thigh cradled in the insubstantial stocking, and the garters with the pale flesh pursed and her full breasts, and the soot-black piping of her eyelids, a gaudish rake of metal dust in Prussian blue, where cerulean moths had fluttered her awake from some outlandish dream, Sutri gradually going awash in the sheer outrageous sentience of her. Their glasses clicked on the tabletop, her hot spiced tongue fat in his mouth, and her hands all over him like the very witch of fuck. He woke later in the night alone in the bed. She was sitting at the dressing table, engaged in alchemic rituals with creams and lotions. She was at brushing her hair. In the dark window, and partly obscured by the old lace drapes, a red pulse of watered light bloomed and faded, and the sound of the rain and the traffic in the wet streets made him sprawl deliciously in the sheets. She was watching him in the glass. She winked.
"Hi, lover," she said.
"Hello, baby. What time is it?" She bent to see her watch.
"It's 12:45, she said. "Did you have a good nap?"
"Hmm."
"Would you like a drink?"
"Yes, I can get it."
"No."
She rose and came over to the bed. She was wearing a pale blue negligee that flowed lightly behind her. She came and bent and kissed him, and he stroked her breasts, and she propped him up with both pillows and fixed the drink and sat on the bed for a moment. "What was all that racket a while ago?"
"Goddamned Ralph came up here trying to get room rent. You wouldn't believe it. Said you were supposed to be in the date room."
"Did you get him straightened out?" She smiled.
"I told him you were no goddamn date. I think I called him a nigger cocksucker."
"How did he go for that?"
"He didn't say. That fucking James has got a big mouth, too."
"Was that Margie in here?"
"Yeah. She's jealous."
"What, of you or me?"
"Silly. Her old man put her down, I think. She's jealous of me, sure, but that chick is almost 50 years old, for Christ's sake."
"I don't see how she makes it."
"She's $100 a night girl."
"Her?"
"Sure. All she has to do is turn 50 tricks. That's mean, isn't it?"
"What brought you down here?"
"Money. What else? Anyway, I can't go back to Chicago for a while."
"You said you were under indictment. What for?"
"Selling my pussy."
Her impish grin. Watching him, he sipped the whiskey. "Where's Og?" he said.
"Oh, he's over here on the floor. I guess his nose is out of joint, too."
She tucked the covers about Sutri's naked chest and went back to her things at the dresser. He had finished the drink and almost drifted into sleep, half sitting there in the sagging bed, when she turned off the light and climbed in beside him, her warm, soft, scented body length to length against his own, and her breath in his ear, whispering obscene endearments. The hammering of steam pipes woke him in the small hours of the night, and he lay in the strange room with the red neon flicker of the hotel sign, silent at the window. Silence in the streets. She sprawled like a child, one hand loosely clutched by the side of her sleeping face. In the morning it was still raining, or raining again. Alone in the room, brailed in the soft and spring-shot bed, he listened to the traffic below the window, the muted slicing of tires in the wet. Looking up at the ceiling, the petals of wallpaper hanging, the old and ornate gas fixture with brass cherubs. He eased himself up. Gray rain leaned past the window. There was some sort of horrendous foundry work going on about the hot water pipes, and a little poppet valve on the radiator was hissing like a kettle. He crossed the cold, buckled linoleum with puckered feet and stood naked by the window and watched the Monday morning traffic in the streets below. A different slant on life here. Old whiskey bottles with their bleached labels lying on the wet tar of the rooftops. A glass skylight covered with chicken wire. The cold winter rain falling everywhere over the city. He put on his clothes and went down the hall to the bathroom. A door with men stenciled across it. A tall, narrow hall of a room in domino tiles. A yellow tub on claw feet, a sink, and a toilet. Sutri pissed long and loud, peering out through the patterned glass of the window at the winter day. When he got back to the room, it was still empty. He took a towel and a bar of soap and went back down the corridor and had a hot bath. When he returned to the room, he tried shaving himself with her electric razor. He looked through her things, careful to leave each as it had been. An eclectic tale of gewgaws, the fine with the shoddy. He borrowed her toothpaste and brushed his teeth with his fingers. She came in smiling and bearing packages and smelling of perfume and rain. She took off the plastic babushka she wore and shook out her hair and came to him, unbuttoning the belted raincoat and looking like a movie whore. She kissed him and said hello.
You haven't eaten? I brought you some coffee and the paper.
What time is it?
It's about 11. Why don't we go over to Regis and have lunch?
Okay.
I'm starving, aren't you?
I'm about to faint. What time did you stir out this morning?
I don't know. 9. Here. Be careful, it's hot.
Thanks. She took off the coat and shook it and laid it on the bed and went to the dressing table to repair her makeup. She seemed ladylike and efficient in her spike-heeled shoes and her tweed suit. Sutri sat on the bed and sipped the coffee and looked at the paper. She watched him in the mirror. She gave him a big, sexy wink. They went down in the elevator with a young black who kept his eyes averted, and she made obscene signals above the back of his small, neat head. They crossed the lobby arm in arm like a honeymoon couple, and she spoke cheerily to the lolling porter and turned up her collar, and they crossed the wet street and ducked into Regis. The next day, they got thrown out of the hotel. Sutri hadn't been back to his room in McAnally, and they had bought him new clothes to wear, and she had picked out a pigskin shaving bag for him and fitted it with all manner of things that he hardly knew the use of, the powders and colognes and lotions and little chrome tools for the care of the nails. They packed all their things down and into a cab and went to the other end of Gay Street, where she talked and gestured by the desk with the black bell captain, and he sat in the back of a cab, half buried in dresses and boxes.
"She's waving you on in," the driver said.
Sutri got out of the cab and entered the little dingy lobby that he'd passed 100 times or more. The cadaverous keeper of the place knew him from the huddle across the street. Sutri nodded to him and went over to the bell captain.
"Bud, this is Jesse," she said.
"Hello, Jesse." Jesse's head moved very slightly.
"Listen, baby, do you want to stay here?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, move out of that cellar and stay here. Look, Jesse is an old friend. He knows me, and he knows I'm not interested in turning $5 tricks with these broken-down whores he runs in here. He's got a room up on the top floor we can have if you want it. I think I'm going to Athens tomorrow."
Athens?
Yeah. I talked to the guy down there this morning. He said I could come for 2 weeks at least. Maybe I could come away from there with a grand if I had someone to take care of it for me.
Suttree, who wasn't all that sure what she was talking about, said that he would. She was very businesslike. She gave him $5, and he went out, and he and the cab driver carried in their things and stacked them on chairs and on the desk and draped clothes over the banister rail. The driver fumbled around for change, but she waved him off, and they went up the stairs with armloads of varied finery.
"This place is a real rat trap," she said, wheezing back at him from the third landing. "But they don't hassle you."
Suttree muttered into a mound of perfumed garments. They were going past gaping fist holes in the stairwell walls and places in the balustrade ripped bare and mended back with raw 2x4s. Down a narrow, ill-lit hall to a door where she leaned and held the key for him to take. It looked like the room they'd left, somewhat smaller, a bit more shabby. They piled everything on the bed and went down to get the rest of it. They strung a piece of wire across a corner of the room to hang the clothes on, fastening one end to the door hinge and the other to the curtain rod bracket above the window. Suttree looked out on the street below. She woke him in the cold dark of morning among the pipe clang and the stridence of whores passing in the hallway drunk, and she was whimpering with fright. He stroked her naked back while she breathed out a dream in the darkness.
"We were in a car, and they dragged you out. They were taking you away. It was awful."
"You don't have any little friends I should know about, do you?" She stroked his face.
"It was just a dream, baby."
In the morning, he put her on the bus, kissing her there at the steps where the driver stood with his tickets and his puncher, and the diesel smoke swirled in the cold, Suttree smiling to himself at this emulation of some domestic trial or lovers parted by fate, and will they meet again? She went along the aisle with her overnight bag and sat by the window and made elaborate gestures of enticement at him through the glass like a whore mute or in such outland port as Christians reck no word of speech there. Until he blew her a kiss and hunched his shoulders to say that it was cold and went up the steps. Now, at noon each day, he wakes to the gray light leaking in past the gray rags of lace at the window and the sound of country music seeping through the water-stained and flowered walls. Walls decked with random, flattened roaches in little corollas of oil stain, some framed with the print of a shoe sole. In the rooms, the few tenants huddle over the radiators, flogging them with mop handles, cooking ladles. They hiss sullenly. The cold licks at the window. In the bathrobe and slippers she has bought for him, and carrying his pigskin shaving case, he goes along the corridor like a ghost through ruins, nodding at times to chance farm boys or old recluses, with skittish eyes emerging from assignations in the rooms he passes. To the bathroom at the end of the hall that no one used save him, the yellow bowl spidered with cracks, the paint-stained tub, the diamond panes in the window looking out on a ledge where pigeons crouched in their feathers lee of the wind. A gravel roof where a rubber ball lay rotting. The city a collage of grim cubes under a sky the color of wet steel in the winter noon. Down the half-wrecked stairs to the lobby, where he'd get the morning paper from a rack and nod to the day clerk, and with his coat collar up, step into the brisk street with the wind cool on his shaven cheek, and down to the Tennessee Cafe, where for 30 cents you could get a stack of hotcakes and coffee cup on cup. J-Bone was still in Cleveland. Others from McAnally, gone north to the factories. Old friends dispersed, perhaps none coming back, or few, them changed. Tennessee wetbacks drifting north in bent and smoking autos in search of wages. The rumors sifted down from Detroit, Chicago. Jobs paying $2.20 an hour. The neon rigging went up early, wan ornaments adorning the bleak afternoon. From the hotel window he watched the traffic, and he could see through the shelled brickwork of the Cumberland Hotel, half raised across the street, the rain falling on the dim, jungled shacks of the black settlement along First Creek. The sound of the factory whistles in the long dead afternoon seemed sad beyond all telling. Suttree, a sitter at windows, a face untrue behind the cataracted glass, specked with the shadow of motes or soot flecks, eyes vacuous. watching this obscure and prismatic city eaten by dark to a pale electric superstructure, the ways and viaducts and bridges remarked from gloom by sudden lamps their length, and the headlights of traffic going through the plum, uncloven rain and the night. To come in half-drunk at a late hour from the huddle, or what worse place, and lie suspended in the bed in this house of derelict pleasures, where half the night all through the cardboard chambers, doors exchanged and brief ruts spent themselves in the joyless dark, and the only sounds ever of desire, the sometime cries of buckled tribids in the hours toward dawn, when trade was done. In the middle of the week, Dick gave him an envelope, postmarked Athens, with a love letter from her, and two naked $100 bills inside. He took from behind the cash register the section of broom handle the key was tied to, and went to the toilet and took out the money and looked at it, such exotic tender, with the values printed bold and green. He folded them and put them in his pocket. Tuesday, she sent three more. He would lay out the five bills on the bed, and he and the stuffed ape would look at them without really understanding them at all. She arrived in the dark of early Sunday morning in a taxi she had taken from Athens, and she was wearing a pair of flannel pajamas and a trench coat, and she had the plastic overnight bag filled with money. She was slightly drunk. She pushed open the door and stood there, framed against the orange and burnt-looking hallway in a classic hooker's pose, and said, "Hey, big boy." Sutry rolled over in the bed to see what was happening, and she said, "How would you like to get fucked?" "Not tonight, honey. I'm expecting her back." She came across the room, shedding her raincoat as she went. "You son of a bitch," she said, laughing. "Watch out, you'll bend the tent pole." "You'll think tent pole when I get through with you." "Young lady, try to control yourself." "Hello, baby." "Hi." They talked all morning. She told him everything. She was from Kentucky, which surprised him. She liked girls, which didn't. And all the towns and cheap hotels, and a couple of lockups, and a few sadistic pimps and tricks, and the cops, and the jails, and the nigger bellhops, while beyond the window dawn unlocked the city in paling increments of gray. They went out to breakfast before the day had even well begun, going up to the corner through the fog and the coal smoke and the smell of roast coffee to hail a cab, Sutry scrubbed and aromatic and pleasantly tired and hungry, and her holding his arm. "What am I supposed to do with all this money?" he said.
"Well, you can buy my breakfast."
"Seriously, I feel like every heist artist in town is watching me."
"How much do you have?"
"The five bills you sent."
"I didn't mean for you not to spend any of it."
"I had some money."
"Well, put it in the bank. I've got another three-something. I thought maybe, I don't know, get an apartment. What do you think?"
"It's up to you."
"No, it's not."
"Well..." They took a cab to Gatlinburg and stopped at a service station to have chains put on the tires. Sutry got two paper cups of ice and poured the ice from the cups into the glasses she had brought, and poured the whiskey over the ice, and they settled back with the blanket over their laps and drove into the winter mountains. The silent cabman carried them through a white silent forest by caves in the roadside cliffs, all toothed with ice, and the only sound the trudge of the shackled tires in the dry snow of the road. Sutry cozied up with his trollop and his toddy, she looking out with child's eyes at this wonderland.
"It's fucking beautiful," she said.
They stopped for icicles to cool their drinks. Sutry clambered over a low stone wall and dropped into deep snow. Down the slope, the firs stood black and brambly in their white shrouds, and a fine mist of snow was blowing with a faint hiss like sand. He pissed a slushy yellow flower in the landscape, standing there with his drink in one hand, looking out on a wild white upland world, as old as anything that was, and not unlike it might have looked a million years ago. Just when he would have said that nothing lived in these frozen altitudes, two small gray birds flew. They came from a clump of snow-broken heather below, and crossed the slope in a loping flight like carnival birds on wires, and vanished in the forest. He walked up the road, his shoes crunching in the packed snow. Under an overhang of ice-bound rock, where sheer palisades of opaque crystal walled up the black forests above, and he could hear the wind suck and moan in the trees. He reached to pluck small icicles from the rocks until he'd filled his glass with them. Back in the cab, she covered him with the blanket and rubbed his hands.
"You're icy cold," she said.
At Newfound Gap, there were skiers, a bright group bristling with their poles and skis about the parked cars. They pulled in to watch them, goggled madmen in clouds of powder dropping down through the fir forests at breakneck speed. She clutched his arm, them standing there with their drinks and their breath swirling in the cold. They went back in the early blue twilight, ghosting down the mountain with frames of snowy woodland veering inverted across the glass. They made love under the blankets in the back seat like school children, and later she sat up and talked into the silent cabman's ear and made him promise not to tell what they had done, and he said that he would not. In the morning, she took him shopping, Sutri in gray tweeds being fitted.
"I love this," she said.
"What, shopping?"
"For men's things. It's sexy."
They selected shirts and ties and cufflinks. They studied shoes in a glass case. A sleek attendant hovered. Wednesday noon, he appeared at Comer's in a pair of alligator shoes and wearing a camel hair overcoat, a pair of beltless gabardine slacks with little zippers at the sides, and a wine-colored shirt with a crafty placket requiring no buttons.
"Foggin' Sutri's robbed Squiz Greens," said Jake.
Stud grinned and wiped the countertop before him.
"What do you have, Sut?"
"I think I'll go for the steak and gravy." Ulysses leaned on the counter and studied him. He took Sutri's lapel between his thumb and forefinger and eased the coat open to read the label, nodding sagely, a toothpick in his mouth.
"Fishing business has picked up a bit, has it?" he said. "Fishy business, more likely," said Sexton,
posed beneath his picture on the wall in flight gear, tapping his thigh with the wooden triangle and watching down the hall.
"Let me have a chocolate milk," said Sutri.
She was gone to Asheville for 10 days. He had a radio in the room now and a rug for the floor by the side of the bed for stepping out onto. In the afternoons, he'd run down ads in the paper for apartments to let, stalking around in cold and barren corridors with half a heart and listening to the chatter of a graying landlord in house shoes with his massive ring of keys like some latter-day jailer saying blah, 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 blah. When she came back, he was still at the hotel. He showed her the bank book. It was in her name, and there was $1,100 in the account. She gave it back to him and smiled and pushed his nose. He watched her while she sat at the mirror and dried and set her hair, himself consumed in woomy lassitude there in the sagging bed, watching her scoop great daubs of cream from a pot and slab it onto her arms and her breasts, her eyes turned to his in the mirror where he lay sipping his drink. She had smeared her face with a size-like caulking that set up in a clown's alabaster mask, crumbling gently in the lines of her smile, a white powder sifting from the cracks. In this theatrical cosmetic, she came to the bed and sat lotus-like, clad only in her panties, and dressed her heels with a stone, her full thigh arched. She bent intently. He bathed and dressed in his new suit and shoes, and the neatly folded silk tie, and Sutri and his soiled dub descended the shabby stairwell and stepped into a cab at the curbside to take them to dinner. Later, they went out to the American Legion, and she won over $100 at the crap table and put it in the top of her stocking, giving him a big whore's wink, while the patrons goggled at that outrageous expanse of flesh. She got a little drunk, and they danced, and she told him she wanted to make love right there on the floor, whispering in his ear and rubbing her cunt on his thigh until he had to take her home. In the morning, she came up with the papers, still in her nightwear under the raincoat, a jug of cold orange juice, and a bottle of aspirin. They sat up in bed together and read the paper and went through the rentals with a pencil. They moved that afternoon. Lugging stuff out of the taxi and up the cold high stairwell to the apartment on the second floor, Sutri poking around in the kitchen, looking in the empty refrigerator, the cupboards.
sitting in the airy front room above Laurel Avenue and staring into space, detached, a displaced soul musing on the hiatus between himself and the Sutri moving through these strange quarters. The cabman stood fingering the brass snap on the leather change pouch at his belt. Sutri looked up.
That's it, ain't it?
I hope so.
Well,
what do I owe you?
$2.40.
Sutra gave him $3 and sent him down the stairs. She was hanging stuff in the closet. He stood in the doorway and watched her.
Imagine a closet, she said.
Imagine. He got ice from the refrigerator and fixed them drinks and came into the bedroom with them.
Is it 5 o'clock yet?
She said. Of course, said Sutri, clicking the glasses. She went into the bathroom, and he stood at the window looking out, the drink in his hand. He could see an old man washing at a sink, pale arms and a small paunch hung in his undershirt. Sutri toasted him a mute toast, a shrug of the glass, a gesture indifferent and almost cynical, that as he made it caused him something close to shame. Toward the middle of February, it grew bitter cold. She went to Chicago, and he didn't hear from her for 10 days. He thought she'd gone back to her girlfriend. The plumbing froze. He spent long hours in bed, his head hanging over the edge of the covers, watching how the purfling of scorpions on the raw and nap-worn carpet went head and tail. Blue and dusky rose, dirt-dulled, a center pattern esoteric and obscure, after a chemical dream or the dried hand of some Eastern adept. One morning at Ellis and Ernest, sadly miscast among the scrubbed college children, sitting at the long pink marble counter, he ordered coffee and flipped open the paper. There was Hoghead's picture. He was dead. Hoghead was dead in the paper. Sutri laid the paper down and stared out at the traffic on Cumberland Avenue this cold, bleak forenoon. After a while, he read the piece. His name was James Henry. In the old school photo, he appeared childlike and puckish, a composition of spots in black and white and gray. How very like the man. He had been shot through the head with a .32 caliber pistol, and he was 21 years old forever. It snowed that night, flakes softly blown in the cold blue lamplight. Snow lay in pale boas along the black tree limbs down Forest Avenue, and the snow in the street bore bands of branch and twig, dark fissures that would not snow full. He trudged home in a light fog of alcohol. A thin and distant bell was sounding, and he stopped to listen. Something flew, nameless bird. Sutri turned his face up to the night. The snowflakes came dodging out of the blackness beyond the lamps to settle on his lashes. Snow falling on Knoxville, sifting down over McAnally, hiding the rents in the roofing, draping the sashwork, frosting the coal piles in the crabbed dooryards. It has covered up the blood and dirt and claggy sleet and gutterways and laid white lattice on the sewer grates. And snow has made cool bowers in the blackened honeysuckle, and it has hid the packing crates in the hobo jungles and wrought enormous pastry rings of truck tires there, where the creek addles along gorged with offal, upon whose surface the flakes impinge softly and are gone. Sutri turning up his collar. In the yards, a switch engine is working, and the white light of the headlamp bores down the rows of iron-gray warehouses in a livid phosphorus tunnel through which the snow falls innocently and unburnt. The Indians' used shoes creaked in the dry snow like chalk. Over his shoulders, he wore a greasy tarpaulin stolen from a donkey engine at a worksite, and his skin was gray with the cold. The snow he stopped to knock from his shoes fell in 2 broken casts on the hallway floor, with the print of the heels and the holes in the shoe soles intact. Leached lines of salt rimed the uppers like creeping frost. He shrugged up the tarp and mounted the dim stairs, a shadow bat-like on the flowered wall, a muted creak and cry of tread, a thin clatter of teeth.
At the door, he breathed on his knuckles and tapped and bent to hear. He tapped again.
"Sutri," he said.
But his voice was timid, and the sleeper within slept deeply. And after a while, he descended the stairs and went away in the winter night.